This is an I Am Listening original podcast.
We would want, ideally, to plan for 5 or more years ahead. And actually what we're doing is we've got like this begging bowl approach where you have to bid for a pound out the till to go and repair something which should have been repaired anyway. That sort of politics and of the last 14 years has been what's really hollowed things out. The number of staff is a fraction of what it was before. So to make change, you need staff to do change and the money to do the change as well. So all of it needs repairing.
Welcome to the Kent Politics Podcast, your go-to source for insightful discussions on local and national political matters. Join us as we take a deep dive into local government across the county. Find out what the key decision makers have to say, what your money is being spent on, and how the party's policies could affect how we live. Plus, don't miss our regular feature, Westminster Watch, where we dissect the latest developments and decisions shaping the political landscape in the heart of the UK's capital. Engage with us as we delve into the issues that matter to you and explore the dynamic world of politics from a Kent perspective.
Welcome to the Kent Politics Podcast. In the week, the Medway Council said it needed 50 million quid to sort out the potholes. The Whitstable public voted against getting a town council, and we know who the runners and riders are in the election for Kent Police and Crime Commissioner. I'm Simon Finlay, local democracy reporter covering Kent County Council, and I'm joined by Robert Boddy, who reports on Medway Council.
Hello.
And Dan Essen, who covers the borough and district councils.
Hello.
And we'll also be speaking to our political editor, Paul Francis, about the week in Westminster. And our special guest is Canterbury City Council leader, Councillor Alan Baldock. First up is Robert. What's been happening in your world?
So a story which all of our listeners will probably relate to is the issue around potholes. Medway Council, like most councils these days, are inundated with complaints about potholes. And they say that the money which the government allocated last November, which is redirected funds from the cancelled HS2, is just not enough. So they've written to the Minister for Roads to try and get this sorted.
Okay, what's the scale of the problem?
So council officers estimate there are currently around 2,000 potholes in across Medway's 500 miles worth of roads. And the government allocated the town's £400,000 for this financial year to make the road improvements. But the required amount, according to the letter sent by Medway Council, says that the figure that they need to bring all the roads up to scratch is close to around £50 million. That's 50 million. Driving along almost any of Medway's roads, it's hard to disagree that this is a real problem. And they say that it's gotten beyond the point of the roads just being a bit uncomfortable for drivers, the odd bump and that sort of thing, and it's graduated to quite a safety concern because of the amount and the depth of these potholes.
So this letter, what is it going to achieve?
Well, Medway Council have, of course, written a few letters recently to the government on various topics, some of which have been successful. They wrote to Michael Gove, inviting him to Medway to discuss the progression of the local plan, an offer which Michael Gove has not taken up. But they also wrote to Jeremy Hunt asking for the Household Support Fund to be extended. It was, though that might be down to the fact that Medway wrote alongside around 160 other councils. And Vince Maple, the leader of Medway Council, said to me that he hoped, since potholes and poor quality roads are a national problem, other councils would join them in calling on the government for better funding.
Okay, thanks very much, Robert. So, Dan, what's been happening at district and borough level?
So a bid to create a whole new town council in Whitstable, which I've been following for a good while now, has been pretty conclusively defeated after a public consultation. Canterbury City Council is going to make the final call next week, but it looks quite guaranteed that Whitstable isn't going to get a new council.
Okay. And who wanted one, and how do you actually go about creating a new council?
So there's a group called the CC5 People's Forum, which covers the whole area. They've been lobbying for a town council for Whitstable for quite some time. In December, the City Council started what's called a community governance review, which you can call after you get a petition with the signatures of just over 7.5% of the electorate, which in this case is about 1,800 people in Whitstable. The campaigners point to examples like Faversham Town Council locally, which is quite active, puts on a lot of events, has quite a high budget and so on. They basically argued that Whitstable gets a raw deal being part of Canterbury District and having no parish or town council of its own. Legally, you know, parish and town councils have exactly the same powers. They wanted their own Whitstable Town Council to be able to put on cultural events, run tourist information centres, maintain parks, bus stops and that sort of thing. But in the consultation, it ended up being pretty unpopular.
So what were people saying about it then?
So the results of Canterbury City Council's consultation on it are available to read online. They're pretty scathing, to say the least. Just over 1,800 people in the area responded, of which 56% said they're against the new town council, which is obviously a pretty far cry from the 1,800 supporters they managed to rally to call in the review. In the comments, people were saying that a new town council would just be a talking shop for local busybodies, that it would be another vehicle for local boomers to object to anything and everything, and another pointless layer of taxpayer-funded bureaucracy, though their words, not mine. A lot of people also said they were worried about just that, the cost. It would be another 60 to 80 quid or so of additional council tax for all residents, and that can increase by an unlimited amount every year. A lot of the proponents of the town council spoke in the language of local democracy, but if you look at the raw numbers, the actual democratic mandate of town and parish councils is pretty limited. You know, not a single town or parish in Kent got more than 50% turnout in their last elections, as far as I've been able to find. That's pretty normal for local government, even at district and county level. But in this case, when not even a couple thousand people in a whole town can be convinced to support creating a new layer of local government, local democracy didn't seem to go particularly well for the people who championed it.
Okay, that's very interesting. Thanks very much, Dan.
So, Simon, what's been going on with you this week?
It's been rather quiet at County Hall because of the Easter school holidays, but I have been looking at the nominations for the election to the post of Kent Police and Crime Commissioner.
For the benefit of listeners, what does the Police and Crime Commissioner actually do? He's not a police officer, is he?
No, he's not a police officer, and it's held by a chap called Matthew Scott, and his job is to be the elected representative of the people of Kent in terms of crime and policing. His role is to hold Kent Police and the Chief Constable to account for the decisions that are being made, and he has a massive overseeing role in the way that the budgets are set. But the Commissioner leaves policing, the operational side of policing, to the police themselves.
In general, does this role work?
Well, it depends who you speak to. Some people say the Commissioner has too little power to effect any real change, and others say that there's too much interference from the PCCs across the country. Others say that it's just a layer of bureaucracy and governance that we just don't need. The Liberal Democrats say the PCC role should be replaced and by elected members on police boards, which is similar to the kind of system that was there before the PCCs came in. The card holder, as I say, is Matthew Scott, and he's been in the post since 2016, and he's seeking to get a third term.
So what's Matthew Scott achieved in 8 years in the job?
His big election boast is that he says that there are now more police officers than ever before in Kent. That's disputed by the Labour Party, it has to be said. And more recently, he has announced a neighbourhood policing pledge, better safety for women and girls, and tackling antisocial behaviour. You know, he's an articulate, presentable, media savvy, and generally very well thought of operator, not only as a politician, but in the commission role as well. The problem is that, and this is true of all PCCs, is that most people don't know who they are, and the lack of profile may well count against them at the elections on May the 2nd.
He's a Conservative, and obviously nationally the Conservatives are suffering in the polls at the moment. Do you think this will affect him? Can he still win?
Well, no one seems to think that he won't win, but he hasn't been too slow out of the blocks either. He got his campaign up and running last year. But he's up against a guy called Lenny Rawls for the Labour Party and another guy called Graham Coley from the Lib Dems. Lenny Rawls and Mr Coley are both credible candidates and both have a legal background.
And what sort of dangers do they pose to Matthew Scott in terms of his election?
Well, there are only three candidates. Both of the other two candidates are credible and both have legal backgrounds, as I've said. Lenny Rawls has been working hard to drum up support, and Mr Coley has run before, so he knows what the system is about. What Mr Scott has no control over is the turnout, which is always low for the commissioner elections. It will be higher in the boroughs, which are holding full council elections on the same day, but overall expected to be pretty low. Secondly, if the Tories don't go out and vote because of the national picture, and there's a fair expectation that they won't, Mr Scott will have to hope much of his support will come in the form of a postal vote. Thirdly, if a proportion of those who do go out switch sides to Labour, then there could be a big surprise. But bearing in mind that Mr Scott polled many more votes than the other candidates combined in the last election, a betting man wouldn't mind backing Mr Scott, I guess. But a lot has happened since the last election. The Tories' popularity has plummeted and the polls are not shifting.
Now, last week we spoke about KCC's proposal to move child asylum seekers to Sheppey. I believe there's been a bit of an update.
Yeah, I believe so. After a huge backlash, the owners of the newly built old age home where the youngsters were going to be put have pulled out of the deal, meaning that KCC now needs to find another place to replace it. A clear demonstration, perhaps, of people power. Well, that wraps it up for what's been happening across Kent and Medway this week. Thanks, Robin and Dan, for your thoughts.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Okay, next up is political editor Paul Francis with his Westminster Watch. So what's been happening then, Paul?
Well, as you yourself said earlier, Simon, it's a relatively quiet week with MPs away on recess, but the local council elections are an ideal opportunity for party leaders to get out and among ordinary voters rather than breathe in the stuffy air in the Westminster bubble. Now, there's an adage about buses only ever arriving in threes that applies to party leaders, well, almost. You have time to speak to some real people, that's voters, in other words. Lib Dem leader Sir Ed Davey was first out of the blocks with a visit to Tunbridge Wells. Why there? Well, it's one of two council elections in Kent, and the party has high hopes of gaining outright control. I know you were there, Simon, but it did strike me as a fairly underwhelming visit with Sir Ed dishing out ample bowls of motherhood apple pie while listing all the reasons why voters should put their cross against the party's candidate. These VIP events promise more than they often deliver, and this is a case in point. I don't know if you agree with that, Simon.
Well, you know, he came and he had basically had a single message to impart, and that was to support the Liberal Democrats in their bid to get full control of Tunbridge Wells Borough Council. So the leader of the Borough Council, Ben Chapelard, was there, but alongside him was the prospective parliamentary candidate, Mike Martin, who fancies his chances in taking the parliamentary seat. So there was one message, as far as we could see, was basically, if we do well in the local elections, then obviously the Tunbridge Wells seat, which is currently held by Conservative MP Greg Clark, will automatically become a number one target.
Do you think that's likely? I mean, how is this council elections squaring up for the Tories and for the Lib Dems?
The Lib Dems are hopeful. The Tories are quietly pessimistic. They're talking it up in public, but behind the scenes, from what I can gather, they think they're going to lose even more than the 11 seats that they have remaining. I mean, Dan's got some insights on this, I believe.
Tunbridge Wells has a very weird system of elections called election by thirds, where in a four-year electoral cycle, they elect one third of the candidates in year one, two and three. And the last time that happened in, I think it was last year, actually, maybe the year before, Tories lost control of the council for the first time in something like 20 years, and they've been pretty bitter about it ever since.
Mm, okay. And obviously that there are borough councils, full borough council elections in Maidstone Borough Council, which is also reverted from that three-year cycle as well. So if the Liberal Democrats do well in those wards that are in the Maidstone and Malling constituency, which has been redrawn, then it may well move up a tier as well and be a second tier as opposed to a third tier Liberal Democrat target. But Sir Ed was not playing ball in terms of talking about which seats they were having a look at. But Mike Martin, when he was on this podcast a few weeks ago, did mention Maidstone and Malling, and he also mentioned Sevenoaks. Why Sevenoaks? I don't really know, but Sir Ed was not being forthcoming about that. Okay, Paul, there's also been another tussle over these biosecurity checks on foreign goods coming into the UK. What's that all about then?
Yeah, it's quite a complicated saga, this, but MPs have ordered a minister to respond to their concerns raised by Dover Port Health Chiefs about a decision not to use a state-of-the-art facility at Dover for biosecurity checks. Mm. The Minister of State, Stephen Barclay, has been given until Monday to respond to claims that are made in a detailed 11-page letter from the Dover Port Health Authority.
Mm. So what does that letter say then?
Well, the letter sets out in fairly complex detail how Port Health officials believe that a decision not to use the facility at Bastion Point in Dover for checks on food being imported from non-EU countries will increase the risk of contaminated products entering the UK. And it warns a decision to switch checks from Dover to the Ashford Border Force facility at Semington would leave a gaping hole that could be exploited, with lorries arriving at Dover and leaving unchecked and uncontrolled to self-present, as they call it, if they choose to, at Semington.
I drove past that Sevington facility the other day. It's quite impressive. It's absolutely huge.
It's big, is it?
Yeah. And very bright at night.
Yeah, the electricity bills are going to be fairly
huge. Yeah, huge, yeah.
But the government does seem to be in a bit of a pickle around about this subject, and there are some serious questions that need answers in relation to the fact that goods coming into this country may well go unchecked because of the distance from Dover to Ashford, where the Sevington site is. And I think that's going to be interesting to see what explanation they can offer as to why this is safe and a way of doing things which will guarantee the highest food safety hygiene standards.
When do we expect to find out what the minister has said in response?
Well, he was given until next Monday, that's a Monday coming, to respond to the DEFRA Select Committee concerns. So it could be any time after Monday.
Okay, thank you very much indeed, Paul.
No problem. Nice to speak to you as always.
Yeah, speak to you next week.
Is there a topic that you would like to be discussed on the Kent Politics Podcast? Perhaps you've got a question for one of our panel, or you'd like to comment on a hot topic in local or national government. Get in touch by emailing or sending a voice note to kentpoliticspodcast@thekmgroup.co.uk.
Now we welcome Alan Baldock, leader of Canterbury City Council, who is speaking to Dan Essen about the challenges of running such an important part of the county.
Councillor Alan Baldock, Labour leader of Canterbury City Council since last May. Thanks very much for coming in.
It's a pleasure. Thank you, Daniel.
So first off, I thought I'd ask about your, you know, about yourself and your journey into politics. You know, when did you join the Labour Party, decide that, you know, being a local councillor was the thing for you?
Wow, that's back in the 90s, them heady Labour days back then. I was what sort of got me really into it, plus too much shouting at the TV and the radio and stuff, and thinking I could do better or not, which everyone does, don't they? Very naive, probably, but that's the way you get into politics, is you want to have a go and see if you can make life better. So there was those journeys, but it's been a long journey since then, and through the Labour Party and through different roles in the Labour Party, and then trying to get elected a few times and failing, and then finally getting elected for a Northgate ward in Canterbury, which I've been there for like 12 years now. So a great honour and a privilege.
So you've been the, you know, Labour leader of Canterbury City Council for almost exactly a year to the day, well, a couple of weeks off maybe. You've been working in coalition with the Liberal Democrats. Were you surprised by the election result last May?
Do you know, we got a few more seats than we predicted, to be honest. Yeah, well, we were surprised and absolutely delighted, of course, as well. But yeah, it was a little bit of a shock.
Fair enough. Were you expecting sort of a reduced... reduced Tory majority, no overall control type thing?
Yeah, I think that's what we were predicting. And of course, in the end, we ended up, you know, in a strong position, certainly with the Lib Dem coalition. So changed things quite considerably.
Yeah, and obviously, you know, no one joins a political party, you know, planning to work in, you know, in coalitions. Everybody wants a majority nationally or locally. How have you found it working with the Liberal Democrats, you know, Labour and Lib Dems, whether or not they're necessarily bedfellows, sort of changes quite frequently?
I think we're just very realistic with each other. I mean, we do come from different places, and we spent a lot of time before the first council, 17th of May, to work out a coalition agreement between ourselves, and that I think is a wise thing that we're advised to do and we wanted to do, and indeed the Labour Party demands that we do. And it just set the parameters up. There's a great many things which we both shared to do, and we've actually done quite a few of them already. And there's things that, you know, we perhaps do as Labour, but we wouldn't do in the coalition. But overall, I'm pretty happy with it, to be quite honest. And we work well together. And the Cabinet is well united in that as well. So very happy.
Quite a few Kent councils, particularly in East Kent, turned red last May. Thanet got a Labour majority. Dover got a Labour majority. You know, up slightly further north in Medway got a Labour majority. Do you think that's a good sign for Labour's prospects in the general election, both, you know, in Kent and across the country?
Yes, I do. I mean, if people want to see what Labour's about, and we are different, you know, and people have almost forgot what Labour's like since those days before. But yeah, to see local Labour is a reflection on national Labour, isn't it? And everything we do in the Labour Party is towards the overall Labour goal, isn't it?
Moving on to sort of similar topic of general election, many people, both in politics and outside and in the media, seem to think it's a bit of a done deal, and that whether it's a majority of one or 100, you know, the Labour Party are probably going to be the next government. But something that interested me recently was Keir Starmer said that he's you know, not necessarily going to commit to giving more money to local councils, despite the fact, you know, councils up and down the country are you know, in pretty serious financial pressure. Does that worry you, given the state of local government finances?
I wish the journey was different. That's for sure. I mean, local councils struggled for years. Certainly the 14 years of Conservative austerity has absolutely followed out everything there about local councils, and we need to rebuild that. But also, I think we are totally realistic that, you know, the finances of the councils are in a complete and utter car crash now. And to even make a change will take years, because we're starting from such a low base. I'd love the Labour Party to commit more money, but more above that, I just want the Labour Party to commit and to plan, allow us to plan ahead, which has been the... And I'll talk more about that if you want to.
What do you mean? Like local government finances being done on too short-term a basis, councils not having enough financial autonomy, that sort of thing?
Absolutely, yeah. And we would want, ideally, to plan for 5 or more years ahead. And actually what we're doing is we've got like this begging bowl approach where we have to bid for a pound out the till to go and repair something which should have been repaired anyway. That sort of politics and of the last 14 years has been what's really hollowed things out. The number of staff is a fraction of what it was before. So to make change, you need staff to do change and the money to do the change as well. So all of it needs repairing. It's a real big, big task. So I can understand the fact of we need to build and to plan ahead.
So moving on to something a bit more local, obviously, I imagine it's been taking up a lot of your time recently. Canterbury City Council is consulting on its local plan, which as a, you know, for the sake of listeners or for the benefit of listeners, governs house building and infrastructure in the district over quite a long period. Yeah, the previous Tory administration was in the process of creating their local plan when, you know, the Labour and Liberal Democrats took control of the council. And there was quite a controversial proposal in that local plan for essentially segmenting the city into traffic zones and limiting how frequently people could drive from one to the other without going onto a ring road on the outside. Pretty much every party other than the Conservatives promised to scrap that in the local elections. In a new version of the local plan, you've removed that. Why did you think it was important to change that policy? Because it generated quite a lot of national attention.
I think with any policy, you have to be realistic. And you need the public to buy into a local plan. You can't impose a local plan without local consent for it. And this was never going to get local consent. And so what's the point of it being there? You know. And also, we believe passionately that, and I think most people, if they're honest with themselves, believe that you can't build your way out of a road crisis. We need to change the way that we operate as an area, Canterbury. There is no road space. We couldn't build enough road space. So we need to change the way we work. And this is the perfect opportunity to move forward with what we call in the bus first policy of active travel and buses and so on and so forth. Being the lead. And that's what the difference is. That's why we can get rid of the zoning model, move towards a different model. And that underpins this new local plan, which everyone knew we were heading towards.
So you think it's important that, at least in Canterbury, that public transport is the focus of local transport planning rather than essentially private cars?
It must be. We need to make that front and centre of what we do.
So local plan is obviously about much more than traffic and transport. It's, you know, something that generates a lot of attention. It's largely about housing. Under the current version of the local plan that's being consulted on, Canterbury's plan to grant permission for, you know, works out to about over 1,000 homes a year, part of which is a whole new village, essentially, of 2,000 homes on land north of the university campus. I've spoken to some people locally who say that, yeah, well, basically they're not happy with the plans, and a lot of people are saying that the, you know, the housing targets are too high. What's your take on that?
Housing targets are set by the government, and many of people have put forward that they think those targets are based on the wrong evidence and all that sort of stuff. But the government set the target. And that's based on the 2014 census, which has some anomalies in it from Canterbury's point of view. And we set those targets, but they are based over a very long period of time, up to 2040. And also the way that local plans go forward now under the new legislation, is there really an iterative plan that moves forward in stages? So if the number of houses to be built could actually change over the period of the local plan, up or down, because we need to keep re-establishing those numbers. So at the moment, we're putting forward what the government asked us to put forward. There aren't any mitigating circumstances we can see to change those numbers. And the most important thing for us now is to try to get through a local plan that is realistic and accepted by the planning inspector.
I see. He'll be one to watch then. So obviously, planning policy and house building is an increasingly hot topic of late. You know, it's getting a lot more national attention than it used to. And a lot of people are saying that Britain hasn't built nearly enough homes of all types for decades. And yeah, likely next Prime Minister, Labour leader Keir Starmer, pretty much openly saying that we need to loosen planning regulation, basically brush aside the NIMBYs and start building again. What do you make of that? Do you look forward to a Labour government which will start, you know, mass house building again, in the even if it means facing down local opposition?
I think we have to just build the right number of houses. The right number of housing is based on evidence, and as long as we keep building those houses, I think we're fine. You know, but we need to also get them built as well. You know, many local authorities don't build out as many houses as they should do. In fact, we've not built out over the previous sort of 10 or so years. We're well behind, and we have other issues as well, things like the Stubmarsh nutrient neutrality problems and all the other things that affect that district. So I'm more relaxed over that, the fact that we have to just keep building houses, as many as the developers will build within the right framework that we've had. We just have to be realistic. As I said before, it's about the realism of the delivery of the plan and what the inspector thinks is a fair and reasonable one.
Alan Baldock, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
Thanks to everyone for joining me on this week's podcast. We'll be back next week when we hear from the regular team and a special guest, Green Party stalwart Stuart Jeffrey, who has just been selected to stand in the Maidstone and Malling seat at the general election. Now, you can follow us on X, formerly Twitter. Just search for Kent Politics Podcast. And don't forget to tune into KMTV at 5 p.m. each Friday for the Politics Show. All the best.
Thanks for listening to the Kent Politics Podcast. Don't forget to check out stories throughout the week on the politics page of Kent Online And you can watch the Kent Politics Show with Rob Bailey on KMTV every Friday at 5pm or on demand at kmtv.co.uk.
This has been an I Am Listening original podcast. For more information, head over to our website, im-listening.co.uk.